Many people have told me so, and children, too. One night, soon after I recognized this fact, I found myself leaving the physical body, but instead of the soaring upward motion, I had a heavy-weighted feeling, as if I were forced to travel in a horizontal position, and suddenly found myself in a narrow, dark street. I found I could just stand upright now, as if I were adjusting myself more easily to the atmosphere, but I did not want to put my feet on the ground as it was covered with mud and slime. Gloomy buildings, like stables, huddled against each other so closely that they almost touched, leaving only sufficient room for one to walk between. Here and there I saw a wider opening, which appeared to lead into a kind of yard, into which the doors of some of the stables opened. I looked in and saw that the yard was crowded with animals, bullocks, pigs and sheep, dead, and yet alive. I knew they were dead. But I could also see that they were alive, too. They moved very slightly, many lay on the ground. I understood at once from their appearance that they had just been slaughtered. I pulled myself together with a tremendous effort. The place and everything in it was so horrible that I did indeed have to make an effort. A great one. I noticed that there was a great difference in the substance of this plane, compared with that of the plains where I had seen ordinary discarnate human life. Even the suicide's plane was different, inasmuch as it seemed fixed and solid. This dreadful place gave me the impression that it had but temporary existence. I will not go into more details of the place and the condition of the animals, but only tell you that it was indeed most dreadful and repulsive in every possible sense. I soon became aware that somebody was speaking to me, somebody whom I could not see, and who seemed to be a long way off. This person, who I afterwards found out was one of my spiritual guides, told me that the place lay between the earth and etheric planes. Its misery was due to the tremendous slaughtering of animals for food that takes place daily. So much strong animal life is suddenly forced out of the actual physical condition into one that is very close indeed to earth, and yet is in no way part of their spiritual world. What happens to the animal astrals, I do not know. I was only shown this horrible scene on the astral side, which followed all the killing and pain on the earth side. In the very air around me was a most definite feeling of terrible fear, suffering, and blind resentment that was even more tangible than the buildings and walls. My guide told me that it was this awful feeling that was to be deplored, not only because it was an indication of the sufferings that these wretched animals had experienced, but because it affected the spiritual and mental atmosphere of the earth, and had a bad effect on human life and progress. Now, up to a short time ago I had been a flesh eater. Every day I had my cutlet, cut off the joint, or piece of chicken. It always looked so nice and appetizing that somehow one hadn't thought of it as being a piece of something that had walked and breathed, and 81. Felt pain and discomfort, just as we do ourselves. From time to time Feder had tried to discourage me and other people, too, from eating meat, but as there is only a limited amount of power that can be used, I had been obliged to devote it to the needs of bereaved sitters, and so had little opportunity of questioning Feder on this point. Now, after all I had seen, and the explanation given me of the reason for the existence of this horrible plane, I felt I wanted to ask several questions, so I got one or two sitters to ask Feder about it, while they were talking to her through me. One thing we asked was, what would happen if we all suddenly stopped eating meat? Surely, the world would be overrun with cattle, sheep and other animals. No, said Feder. You wouldn't be overrun with them because you would stop breeding them. there would not be anything like the number you have got if you hadn't purposely encouraged them by breeding them. She said that, in time, as people understood more of the spiritual world, they would eat less flesh, and be better for it, and from my own more recent personal experience, I have come to the definite conclusion that Feder was right. Since I gave up meat entirely a few years ago, my health has improved very much, in spite of strenuous work done under sometimes very difficult conditions. My husband, too, has found great benefit through becoming a vegetarian, and the same has been told us by many of our friends. My mind is clearer, and I am more open to direct spiritual guidance than I used to be. You must not think that all animals that die, or have to be put to sleep, go to such places as I have described. An animal that you have loved and who has loved you, whether it be horse, dog, cat, or bird, goes usually to the third sphere where somebody takes care of it, and where it leads a normal animal life, except that it doesn't reproduce its species as it would on Earth, and is even brought to see you at times while you are still on Earth. I know you will meet your pets, the animal companions that you have loved. I have seen my special cat, and also a dog, a Pekingese, to whom my husband and I were much attached. It seems as if the animals who love, and are loved, attain to spiritual rights and have an afterlife in the spiritual world, just as we do. Whether their post-physical lives continue forever, I do not know. I rather doubt it, that is, I doubt if they continue everlastingly in animal form, but they certainly live for a considerable time in the shape we loved and knew them by, and, thank goodness, they will live with us again when we pass over. 82. Chapter 24, My Brown Self. I think that there are planes of an intermediate kind, where the higher spirit guides and teachers can meet us when we leave our bodies during sleep. These intermediate planes are not, I think, in the same sphere or condition to which people go when they pass over after death. To me there seems to be a difference. One feels it but cannot explain it. About 6 years ago, after retiring at night and settling myself for sleep, I found I was leaving the body, and had a curious feeling that quite an interval passed during which I was traveling through space in what one would call a blindfold condition. I knew that I was being escorted by one or more spirit people in whom I felt complete confidence. Though I could not see them, I only felt them. After a time, the blindfold condition began to disappear gradually, and I found myself in some kind of building, like a school or institution. The feeling it gave me was neither happiness nor unhappiness, though I am usually very sensitive to places, whether on the earthly or spiritual plane. I simply felt I was there for some definite purpose. The room in which I stood was well lighted, and a passage led from it, not so light. At the end of the passage was a door leading into a darker room. A voice directed me to go into this room, and I obeyed unquestioningly. At first I could not see what was in there. Room, it seemed so dark after the lighter atmosphere, so I passed round and at last made out a low chair or seat in one corner, and reclining on this seat was the figure of a woman, apparently asleep. The sight of her gave me a feeling of deep depression. There was something about her that was so, not repulsive, but sad. For one thing, everything about her was brown. Her dress, hair, and even her skin, were of a dull, muddy brown. As I stood there, I felt an overwhelming pity for her. She seemed to be so sad, without hope, stupid, blundering. I felt all this, and my heart overflowed with pity for her. I must help her, I thought. I must give her something of the spiritual happiness, the inspiration, and hope that I am so conscious of. I bend over her, as one would over a child, intending to put my arms around her, and pour out all the encouragement and counsel I felt would help her. Just as I was doing so, the woman stirred slightly, and half opened her eyes, and I saw to my great astonishment and consternation, that it was myself. It was just as if I were looking at myself in a very dirty, dark mirror. It was a terrible shock, and I stood paralyzed, not knowing what to do or say. "Oh, you poor ugly thing," was the only thought in my mind. After looking at her for what seemed an eternity, I heard a voice, though I could not see the speaker. It was a deep resonant voice, like a note on the organ. At the time, every word and every tiny inflection of the voice was deeply impressed on my mind, but now I, 83, can only remember that this voice told me that the brown woman, as I have always called her in my mind, was my lower self, and that my mediumship, my association with higher entities, and the advantages I had had through the development of my psychic faculties, had not brought about the spiritual and ethical improvement in my earthly self that there might have been. It appears that a great deal is expected of anyone with whom the guides cooperate, and who develops the power of traveling and seeing the spiritual planes firsthand, in addition to the privilege of being able to converse with and see those who have passed over. Never before had I realized that when I received help from the other side in developing myself psychically, I was incurring a heavy responsibility, for which I must at some time render an account. This applies, I know, to all those who, while still living in the physical body, are desirous of communicating with their loved ones who have passed over. It is not only a question as to whether we can establish communication, either through a medium or direct, but what is it going to do for us, or what are we going to let the greater knowledge make of us? Yes, the privilege of communicating brings a great spiritual and moral responsibility to us, which we cannot and must not shirk. All this was told me at length by the voice. I did not imagine it, and not a word or idea of it had been in my mind. Indeed, it was all a great shock to my self-esteem, as I had rather prided myself on taking care of my power, using it to help others and so on. But I was told that was not nearly enough, that there was so much selfishness and vanity and intolerance, allied to a disposition to take the line of least resistance if anything very unpleasant had to be done, or anything that would make me unpopular. Oh, the voice certainly put me through it. Every scrap of my self-complacency dwindled into nothingness before the beautifully modulated, even tones that thrust these unpleasant truths at me. It never entered my head to rebel, or deny any of it. After the first shock, I made up my mind, even while the voice was speaking, that I would take my lower self in hand on my return to my physical body. I looked again at the brown woman as the resolution formed definitely in my mind. I thought I saw a slight lightening or clearing up of the muddy depressing shade, and gradually she melted before my eyes, while I was conscious of being drawn away from the place, down and back to earth, though the voice still kept beside me, quietly telling me what my faults were, and all I had to eradicate. On awakening, I remembered every detail of what had happened, and every word spoken to me. It was not really like awakening from sleep, but as if one passed from one room into another. There is usually no period of unconsciousness between leaving the spiritual state and re-entering the physical one, at least, I have felt none. I lay in bed and pondered over my strange experience, and wondered why I had been given their lesson just then. As I lay wide awake, but with my eyes closed, I heard the voice again. telling me that my physical health had been in a condition which, though not apparently serious in itself, was leading to a crisis in which I should need not only help from my spirit friends, but from my own higher self, which was even more important. Shortly after this, I had the septic poisoning from my teeth, for which Miss McGregor gave me such splendid help, as I have related in an earlier chapter. 84. I realize now that had I ignored the lesson that had been given me, and refused to bring my spiritual development into line, or even ahead of the psychical progress I had made, I could not have taken the help given me by my guides and spirit friends both through Miss McGregor and in other ways. Evidently one has to be able, as well as willing, to receive help from higher sources. Apropos of this, a funny but rather pathetic incident occurs to my mind. In the early days of the Great War, a bereaved father visited me with the hope of communicating with his only son who had been recently killed at the front. Father and son had evidently been devoted to each other, the one seemed lost indeed without the other. I felt it would be a difficult sitting, because the poor man was so sure that there couldn't be a God, there couldn't be an afterlife, there couldn't be any loving providence, or anything of the kind. In a world where such a war went on, and where thousands of fine young lives were thrown away daily. He explained all this to me while I was arranging the room, and endeavoring to get him to settle quietly in his chair for the sitting. Well, Fader brought his son to him, and he gave his father so much proof of his identity that he was staggered, and after their seance he went away without saying much to me, but he made an appointment for another sitting at an early date, I think it was a few weeks later. After this second sitting he told me he had received so much evidence that he was now sure that it was his son who had communicated with him, and who showed him that he still loved him, was near him at times, and looked forward to their being together again. He said he could no longer doubt either survival itself, or the possibility of communication. I felt very happy, as I had been particularly sorry for this man. Suddenly he threw his notebook violently down on the table, and started to stride up and down the room. He drew his hand across his forehead with a bewildered gesture, and cried out, "Damn it! Knowing this new truth about the life to come, and my son and others seeing me, and knowing what I am doing, it's all going to be an infernal nuisance. To me, it's going to revolutionize my business life. I can't go on conducting things on their old lines, I'd be ashamed. Yes, damn it, this is going to give me some trouble." He said more than this, and his language was much more lurid, but I didn't mind. I saw that this boiling over of his sense of responsibility was really the outcome of his great relief and joy in finding his boy again. In other words, this hardened agnostic had understood in two short sittings the lesson it had taken me several years of intensive study and development to learn. 85. Chapter 25, Physical Phenomena. In writing this book I am hoping that it will be read to some extent by people who have had little or no personal experience of the vast subject of physical phenomena. Indeed, my object in writing about my early difficulties in as simple, straightforward manner as possible, is chiefly that it may encourage some interested reader into taking his courage in both hands, and investigating for himself, so my more sophisticated and experienced friends must forgive me for sometimes explaining in a rather elementary way things with which they are so familiar that they probably know a great deal more about them than I do. So far, I have spoken mostly of what we call mental phenomena and mental mediumship, with the exception perhaps of that one incident where Florence, Nelly and I demanded an objective manifestation of power, and which resulted in the rather terrifying experience of the hairy arm around Nelly's neck, also some of the earlier phenomena that we experienced during our table sittings, such as the silhouette saw shadow forms on the walls, and the loud knocking which kept time with our singing, and again, later on, the strong scents I told you about. These would all come under the heading of physical phenomena. We usually speak of all objective phenomena as belonging to the physical class, because their results can be felt, seen and heard by the physical senses of touch, sight, and hearing, and we speak of subjective phenomena as belonging to the mental class, because one perceives, or senses, or recognizes it, through the channels of the mind. I think many people would be puzzled to know into which class they could put some of my psychic experiences, because sometimes, when I have heard a voice, I have heard it objectively, yet I am a mental medium. Also, I have had touches, and little manifestations, when quite alone, which were seen and heard by my physical eyes and ears, and not by any inner sense. It may be that in every one of us there is some slight amount of the kind of power that is called physical, and given the right condition, a little can be squeezed out suddenly by an unseen operator, and this results in our experiencing an unexpected and spontaneous manifestation of an objective character. Whenever that happens to me, I am always aware of a very slight suspended or blank feeling. For perhaps the fraction of a second my mind and senses are held up, and immediately there follows the manifestation. In that very brief interval I think that some unseen friend has managed to draw just the small amount of power from me that was necessary for his job. So now I want to tell you about physical mediumship and phenomena, which I suppose appeal to many people as being the most interesting and thrilling of all. Looking back, I can see how many more real thrills I have had in this way than I have ever known. Through seeing the most exciting and absorbing play, or reading the most fascinating 86 book. My first experience in this direction, except for those with Florence and Nelly, came after I had begun my work as a professional medium, early in 1915, when I had there great privilege of taking part in a series of sittings with a well-known materializing medium. Up to this time, my husband had been unable to take any practical share in our sittings at home, as Afeda had always said that he must not sit with me when she was controlling me, as he also had the ability to go into trance, but into a deeper state than mine, and that it might be bad for his health unless he was able to develop gradually and cautiously as I had done. Of course it was impossible to find time and strength to devote ourselves to such an object, in addition to my work, so we agreed that my husband must keep normal, and not seek to develop psychically in any way, and that if he followed this course, his power could be utilized by the guides in helping me. In fact, my own power would be augmented by some of my husband's, and I have had abundant proof that this is so. What it amounts to is, I appear to give the sittings, with Feda controlling me, but my husband undoubtedly takes an unseen part in it, and I have found that I am, to a certain extent, dependent on him for power. For instance, in the early days of my professional work, we were having a hard struggle to make ends meet, as there were so many people who needed my services, and that of many other mediums, and who have not only lost their loved ones in the war but sometimes their source of income as well. These people needed a help even more than those who had suffered loss of the companionship of husband, sweetheart or brother, but were spared financial ruin. So we were not too affluent in a material sense. And when my husband was offered quite a good and easy engagement to tour in their provinces, we literally jumped at it, thankful to know that I should be able to carry middle dot on my work, which needed all my strength and vitality in those trying and anxious times. Without the worry of wondering how to meet the expenses of the flat, firing, lighting, and the higher cost of living that very quickly made itself felt. To our surprise, Fedo was not at all enthusiastic about this engagement, and after my husband had been away a month or two and was getting on very comfortably, under a congenial management, she announced that he must come back at once and stay back. As she found she could not use the power, or had not sufficient of it, during his absence. She was imperative about it, and we certainly found that the quality of my sittings improved after my husband's return, so we have never since risked a separation for more than a few days at a time. Until early in 1915, although my husband had heard of my experiences with Florence, Nelly and Agnes, and other friends, and was aware of all that Fedor was doing through me, he had had no first-hand experience of his own at all. He read literature on spiritualism occasionally, but always used to say that he couldn't get up any great enthusiasm for reading very deeply on the subject until he had some personal contact with the other side. So when I came into touch with a really powerful materializing medium, I thought what a splendid opportunity for my husband to see and hear 87. Something for himself. Of course I ought to have initiated him gradually, by sitting at their table regularly, but in those days I had not the power, vitality or time left for many personal sittings after I had finished my professional work each day. It did not occur to me that though a materializing seance might be very convincing and thrilling, it might also be an extremely alarming experience to one who was a complete novice in these matters. 88. Chapter 26, See More Than We Bargained For. About a dozen of us assembled with the medium in an absolutely bare room, bare except for a plain bentwood chair for each sitter and one for the medium, a small octagonal table measuring about 2.5 feet across, and a pair of serge curtains hung across one corner of the room, and a couple of oblong pieces of thin wood, about 12 inches by 6 inches, painted on one side with strong luminous paint which, it was explained to us, were to be used by the materializing spirits to hold near their faces, so as to illuminate their features more clearly. The medium referred to these painted boards as slates. The floor was entirely covered with linoleum. All the sitters were known to each other, but were strangers to the medium. In these sittings the sitters were placed in horseshoe formation, men and women alternately, their open ends of the horseshoe ending close to the curtained corner, in which the medium sat for part of the seance. The medium left the gas jet fairly full on in the early part of the sitting. One could read quite small print by the light. The door was locked. The medium now stood in front of the curtains, within the horseshoe formed by the sitters, with the little table, the presence of which puzzled me, by his side. He asked us to join hands, the two sitters ending the horseshoe closing their free hand over their hand that clasped the next person's hand. This, we were told, was to shut in the power until it had become strong enough to use the magnetic power set up by this procedure. Soon made itself felt, it was like a weak electric current. After a couple of minutes, the medium went behind the curtains, and we heard him rubbing his hands vigorously and breathing hard. Another few minutes, perhaps 8 or 10, and he suddenly flung back the curtains and came out into the circle. We scarcely knew him. I looked closely at him to make sure it was the same person. He appeared to be at least 2 or 3 inches taller, with a most commanding, one might say, imperious, almost dictatorial manner. He broke out into fluent French, and one of their sitters replied to him. He explained that he was a French-Canadian doctor, who was the regular control of this medium, and he said that as he gained more control over there,